Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
All right, calm down, people. It's just Free for All Friday. Don't panic. Don't get into a hysteria. Don't launch into a mass hysteria. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. We can all calm down. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, we talk apologetics, theology, how to explain and defend our Catholic faith. But on Fridays, we talk about weird stuff. We talk about whatever I find to be interesting. I bet you'll find it interesting as well. So today, I want to talk about mass hysteria. I'm really interested in the weird, the paranormal, the bizarre, the supernatural. I had that in common with my colleague, Jimmy Akin, who also hosts a podcast called Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. I've had Jimmy on the podcast before to talk about weird, bizarre things like unexplained sounds or the mysteries of the American South. And it's always enjoyable to have Jimmy on because he's such a calm, rational presence. And that's important when people can get frightened by things that they don't understand. And Jimmy does a good job of balancing approaching things from a perspective of faith and reason. So if you want to go back in the archives of the show, just search Council of Trent, C-O-U-N-S-E-L, Jimmy Akin. Because if you search the regular Council of Trent, Jimmy's written a bunch of articles on that. I think you'll really enjoy those shows. But so I won't be surprised, though, if in a few weeks or months there is an episode on mass hysteria on Jimmy's podcast, because we usually independently arrive at similar topics when we want to investigate the strange and bizarre. But who knows? Maybe my podcast will cause Jimmy to do a podcast, and then people will listen and become all hysterical, and everybody is going to be making podcasts about mass hysteria. So, well, what is mass hysteria? According to this article, in sociology and psychology, mass hysteria, also known as mass psychogenic illness, collective hysteria, group hysteria, or collective obsessional behavior, is a phenomenon that transmits collective illusions of threats, whether real or imaginary, through a population in society as a result of rumors and fear. A common type of mass hysteria occurs when a group of people believes that it is suffering from a similar disease or ailment, sometimes referred to as mass psychogenic illness or epidemic hysteria. Okay, so that's a basic operational definition of mass hysteria. And one reason I wanted to look into this, aside from the episodes of mass hysteria being absolutely fascinating, and they're all different and varied, they have a lot of things that are in common, but the differences are striking in what you see people becoming hysterical about, is that I'm preparing for a debate on the resurrection in a few months on Matt Frad's Pints with Aquinas podcast. And some atheists say that the apostles' testimony of Jesus having risen from the dead was just an example of mass hallucination or mass hysteria. But when we compare what the New Testament records of the apostles seeing the risen Jesus and Jesus' appearances to different individuals and groups, it doesn't line up with the medical literature or the historical literature on mass hysteria. So let's jump into that. Let's look at some of these examples, the most famous cases of mass hysteria in history. Okay, so let's jump into some of these examples of mass hysteria. One of the oldest examples and the most famous examples are outbreaks of dancing mania. I'm not talking about Footloose, not talking about Saturday Night Fever. This happened a lot in the Middle Ages. They first are reported in the 13th century, but then you see that the reports of them die off and then almost completely vanish after the 17th century. So this is kind of a late medieval, early modern phenomenon where entire villages would break out into fits of uncontrollable dancing. It was called dancing mania or the dancing plagues. And just the entire towns would erupt into uncontrollable fits of dancing. There have been some reports that people danced so much that they danced themselves to death. Does anyone remember Hocus Pocus, by the way? Remember Hocus Pocus with Bette Midler and Sarah Jessica Parker? Pretty good Halloween movie. You think about Halloween movies, there's only, you know, Nightmare Before Christmas, Halloween, the horror movie. I remember Hocus Pocus, there was a scene where the witches put a spell on everybody to dance through the night, and then they would just dance to their death. So that just popped in my mind. Mostly I wanted to see if anybody else remembered the movie Hocus Pocus. If you do, leave a comment at trenthornpodcast.com if you're a premium subscriber to validate that popped into my mind. So in any case, the detail about people dancing to death, that might be an urban legend that was ascribed to these real historical events. And I should amend what I said before. I think actually it goes back to the 7th or 8th century, so it's definitely a medieval phenomenon. But it does reach kind of a peak after the 13th century, dies off in the 17th century. It says here, further outbreaks occurred during the 13th century, including one in 1237, in which a large group of children traveled from Erfurt, I believe that's a town in northern Germany, it's where Martin Luther was from, actually, to Arnstadt, in similarity to the legend of the Pied Piper of Hamelin, a legend that originated at around the same time. There's the guy, you know, he played the pipe and lured the children away from their villages. Another incident in 1278 involved about 200 people dancing on a bridge over the River Meuse, resulting in its collapse. Many of the survivors were restored to full health at a nearby chapel dedicated to Saint Vitus. This dancing mania was also called Saint John's mania or Saint Vitus's plague, Saint Vitus's mania, because sometimes people believed that it was associated with a particular patron saint, like Saint Vitus or Saint John the Baptist, even possibly being involved in cursing people with some kind of a dancing plague. So we can see there are definitely religious elements in these aspects of mass hysteria. For example, it says in the 17th century, incidents of recurrent dancing were recorded by the professor of medicine Gregor Horst, who noted, this is what he wrote down at the time, several women who annually visit the chapel of St. Vitus in Dreffelhausen dance madly all day and all night until they collapse in ecstasy. In this way, that might have been where the reports of people dancing to death came from. In this way, they come to themselves again and feel little or nothing until the next May, when they are again forced around St. Vitus's Day to betake themselves to that place. One of the most famous outbreaks occurred in July 1518 in Strasbourg. It's also called the Dancing Plague of 1518, where a woman began dancing in the street and between 50 and 400 people joined her. Further incidents occurred during the 16th century when dancing mania was at its peak. So what caused this dancing mania in the Middle Ages and why did it end up going away after the 17th century? Well, there's different hypotheses. One hypothesis is that dancing mania occurred in villages where something called, I think it's ergot, E-R-G-O-T, a kind of fungal mold that can cause hallucinations, was growing on bread. And so when the villagers ate the same batch of bread, communal bread in the town, or wherever this fungal mold was spreading, it would cause them to have hallucinations, and then they ended. It was the result of the mold. But a lot of later researchers say that it doesn't seem like the mold theory can account for how the dancing mania spread so quickly, and that there wouldn't be enough people eating the certain kind of bread at a certain time to instigate mass outbreaks of 50, 100, or 500 people all dancing together. Another theory is that some people were just, that medieval life was just so awful, the drudgery of famine and infant mortality and the dreariness of medieval life, that people were just trying to dance off stress. Or in some cases, they were dancing so much they wanted to try to reach fits of ecstasy. And so people saw a few people engaging in this behavior and then wanted to join in. And this kind of group dynamic makes sense. Our brains are very primitive things. I mean, think about when you get scared of something, you're in an irrational state or you're tired or you're frightened. It's easy for our brains to make convenient jumps of logic that are actually irrational. So one thing our brains do that allow us to be sucked into mass hysteria is to say, oh, everybody around me is freaking out. Everybody around me is usually right. Therefore, I better be freaking out too. And that happens. Think about in the news when we hear a news story and people are all worried about something. This even happened with COVID. Now, just to be clear, I do believe COVID-19 is a legitimate thing to be concerned about if you're in a particular age group or health bracket. If you're very elderly, or if you have certain pre-existing conditions, COVID-19 is something to be concerned about. But I do think this could be considered a somewhat case of mass hysteria when you have people who are maybe not mass hysteria, but a mass panic rather than a mass hysteria. When you have people who are not in any of the age brackets or health brackets to put them at risk of COVID-19, and they just hear these anecdotal accounts of someone in their age bracket dying from this, and then they refuse to leave their house. It's like someone who's really, really concerned about child abduction and is absolutely terrified that a stranger will take their children, even though when you go to a place like the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, they'll tell you that out of the 500,000 examples of children reported missing every year, only 100 of them were taken by a non-family member. Most missing children are abducted by, you know, estranged spouses, divorce settlements, things like that. So my point with the mass panic is that people will irrationally believe something and act in accordance with that against the face of facts and evidence. So our brains are predisposed to follow the crowd instead of following the evidence. That's something we always have to work on really hard when we're trying to arrive at true beliefs. Because our brains, you know, want to conserve energy for us to find food and shelter. And so it's easy just to do what the tribe is doing. So we are conditioned to follow the crowd rather than to follow the evidence. And that's something we always have to work to overcome. And I think mass hysteria is that example of people seeing others freaking out or being hysterical and being conditioned to follow the crowd in that way. So I think that the dancing hysteria could be related to a few individuals trying to find ecstatic fits. That makes sense. If you've ever been to like a big dance party or a block party and everyone's dancing together, you do kind of lose yourself in it, right? Have you ever been in that situation? You're at a high school dance and everybody's having a ton of fun. In fact, the word ecstasy, ekstasos, means to be outside of oneself, like to almost have a kind of out-of-body experience that you're so caught up in the moment and in this joy, it's a feat of ecstasy. So that's what I think might explain a lot of the dancing mania stuff. All right, moving on. Our next two examples of mass hysteria is hysteria about a criminal or some kind of monstrous figure stalking people that might have been connected to actual attacks. Possibly, we don't know, but then kind of spread as a mass hysterical element. The first one is Spring-Heel Jack. This is a figure who stalked people in the alleyways of London in 1837 and also up in Scotland. It was a figure who would stalk after women and was called Spring-Heel Jack because he was claimed to be able to jump incredible distances as if, you know, there were springs on his heels. You look up pictures of him drawn from old comics and depictions from the late 19th and early 20th century. It's scary, but also kind of funny, the getup that they have. I guess in England, there's a lot of Jacks that terrorize people. You got Spring-Heel Jack, Jack the Ripper. I don't know if that's because in England, if you don't know somebody's name, a guy's name, he's just Jack. Like kind of like how in America, we might say that that's an average Joe. So I don't know. I'm going to have to talk to David Bates, who is the host of Pints with Jack. So that is another Jack. See, there you go. I'm going to have to ask him about it. David hosts a wonderful podcast called Pints with Jack about C.S. Lewis. So I've actually asked him once, I sent him an article and I asked him to translate British for me. To translate British English because the terminology and the slang and colloquialisms were so far removed, I had no idea what the people were talking about. So I'm going to have to ask him why there are so many Jacks, Spring-Heel Jack, Jack the Ripper, things like that. So this occurred in 1837. It says, Spring-Heel Jack was described by people who claimed to have seen him as having a terrifying and frightful appearance, clawed hands, eyes that resembled red balls of fire, a black cloak, and he wore a helmet and a tight-fitting white garment. He's tall and thin with the appearance of a gentleman. And some people say he was able to speak comprehensible English, but he was someone who was able to leap tall buildings. So then the story continued to spread. Lots of other people claimed to have encountered Spring-Heel Jack. It eventually turned into a boogeyman story where people would tell their children at night, if you don't behave, Spring-Heel Jack is going to jump up here up to the window and get you, which, of course, would contribute more to the hysteria about it, though reports of Spring-Heel Jack seem to have declined after the 1870s. What are some of the conclusions, you know, some of the theories about it? You have the paranormal explanations that it was some kind of an alien or a monster or a demon. Other people believe that there were aristocrats, which is a good film, by the way, aristocrats and upper class individuals who enjoyed playing pranks on other people, especially people in the lower classes, and would wander the streets and do this kind of stuff. So it says here, Spring-Heel Jack was widely considered not to be a supernatural creature, but one or more persons with a macabre sense of humor. A popular rumor circulating as early as 1840 pointed to an Irish nobleman, the Marquis of Waterford, as the main suspect. So the idea here is that you have these rich guys, rich frat guys walking around, dressing up to look as ghoulish as possible to scare people. And then the story takes on a life of its own. So going across the pond, we have a similar case in Mattoon, Illinois, a very small town in Illinois. Today only has about 20,000 people who live there. But this is the case of the Mad Gasser of Mattoon, also known as the Anesthetic Prowler, the Phantom Anesthetist, or simply the Mad Gasser, was the name given to the person or people believed to be responsible for a series of apparent gas attacks in Mattoon, Illinois during the mid-1940s. More than two dozen separate cases of gassings were reported to police over the span of 2 weeks, in addition to many more reported sightings of the suspected assailant. The gasser's supposed victims reported smelling strange odors in their homes, which were soon followed by symptoms such as paralysis of the legs, coughing, nausea, and vomiting, though no one died or had serious medical consequences. So what happened here, it starts in August 31st, 1944, when you have individuals who awaken to a strange odor in their home and then a feeling of being nauseous or even paralyzed and unable to move. The first report that's connected to the gasser is at August 31st, 1944, a gentleman named Urban Rafe was awakened during the early hours of the morning by a strange odor. He felt nauseated and weak and suffered from a fit of vomiting and suspected that he was suffering from domestic gas poisoning, like, you know, just natural gas released in their home. Rafe's wife tried to check the kitchen stove to see if there was something wrong with the pilot light, but found that she was paralyzed and unable to leave her bed. Then there was another incident reported by a young mother. We don't have a lot of details on that, just that she and her daughter were coughing, unable to get out of bed. Then the next day, September 1st, there was another incident, Mrs. Kearney on Marshall Avenue. So this took place in Mattoon, Illinois, on Marshall, Grant, and Prairie Avenue. I've looked this up online. It's in the relatively triangulated same part of the town on the western side of the town. This is important for a natural explanation that may come up later. That's the same thing. She noticed an odor becoming stronger, lost feelings in her legs. But where the gasser comes in is that police were contacted because there was evidence of a prowler. At around 12:30 a.m., Bert Kearney, Mrs. Kearney's husband, a local taxi driver, returned home to find an unidentified man hiding close to one of the house's windows. The man fled and Kearney was unable to catch him. So what happened here is that the first attacks on September 1st, you have just the odors and people experiencing nausea and paralysis. But it was on September 1st when the first case was reported to the media and it connected it to the prowler. And there was a newspaper headline that said something like, Mrs. Kearney and daughter, first victims of the gasser. And so if you're reading that newspaper headline, it makes people think like first victims, as in the newspaper was suggesting there are going to be more victims. And that ignited the panic later that you have more reports coming in on September 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th of individuals saying that they had smelled a strange odor, they were feeling sick, or had seen a prowler outside of their homes. And so that created this hysteria that lasted for about 2 weeks. And the local police, though, at the very beginning said that the majority of these cases were just examples of hysteria. One of the police officials, the commissioner of public health, Thomas Wright, says, he said at the time, there is no doubt that a gas maniac exists. Like, that's not going to make the hysteria worse. And has made a number of attacks. But many of the reported attacks are nothing more than hysteria. Fear of the gas man is entirely out of proportion to the menace of the relatively harmless gas he is spraying. The whole town is sick with hysteria. Though the chief of police later said on September 12th that he didn't think that there was a gasser at all, that people were just overreacting to these odors. And you had just that one isolated example of who could have been a burglar or just a vagrant or a transient or a peeping Tom that gets connected to the odors. And people think, oh, here's these strange odors. Here's this strange man. They must be connected, but they might not be connected. A common theory to explain some of the cases is that these might have been odors that came from a local industrial plant or some kind of factory. There might have been a chemical leak of some kind or a confluence of natural odors and industrial odors that come together to make people feel ill. So that might have happened to some of the earlier individuals. But once the hysteria and the panic set in, people who spilt nail polish or any odor that was just out of the ordinary, people are already on edge and afraid of the Mattoon gasser. I like the anesthetic prowler. I think that has a nice that nice ring to it. But they're already so afraid of it, they're ready to leap at the conclusion, oh no, the gasser is here to get me, when it's just an ordinary, unusual odor that pops up every now and then, and these people have let their imaginations run wild. So the mad gasser of Mattoon, that would be our mass hysteria to rival spring-heeled Jack, of these boogeymen hiding in the darkness waiting to pounce. And jumping forward a few decades, on another continent would be the Tanzania laughing epidemic in 1962. So the last two we heard, spring-heeled Jack and the Mattoon gasser, these are crime-related mass hysteria, that someone hears about a threat. And the threat in this case is a bad man coming to get you. And so every shadow lurking around a corner is that bad man. So that would be kind of one kind of mass hysteria. The Tanzania laughing epidemic, though, seems a lot more similar to the dancing mania we began to talk about. The laughter epidemic began on January 30th, 1962, at a mission-run boarding school for girls in Kishasha. So this is in Tanzania, but I believe at the time the country was called Tanganyika. It was once united with, I think it was Zanzibar. This is in southern Africa. This occurred right after the nation got its independence from the United Kingdom. So that was back when it was called Tanganyika, but today it's called Tanzania. So I'm just going to call it Tanzania, so that's easier. But it wasn't called that at the time. It started with three girls and spread throughout the school, affecting 95 of the 159 pupils who were high school age. Symptoms lasted from a few hours to 16 days. The teaching staff were unaffected and reported that students were unable to concentrate on their lessons. The school closed on March 18th, and the epidemic spread to Nishamba, a village where several of the girls lived. And then in April and May, 217 young villagers, so it's usually young girls, have these kind of laughing fits or laughing attacks. And so that spread in the spring and early summer of 1962 at the boarding school in Tanzania and at some of the nearby villages. So what explains the laughing epidemic? A lot of researchers think that this was stress-induced mass hysteria, that the girls were under a lot of pressure to perform academically well in light of Tanzania earning its independence, and kind of a clash in cultural values that were happening at the time. There was a lot of tumultuous cultural events that were happening around this independence. And so some of the girls just basically snapped under the pressure and engaged in these bouts of laughing fits. And then it spread as other girls see, oh, well, they're being strange. Maybe I should be strange as well. And once it reaches that critical mass, it starts to take over. And laughter can be a very infectious behavior, similar to dancing. It could be the case in some of these mass hysteria examples that some forms of human behavior are just contagious. I mean, think about yawning, for example. Why is it that when you see someone yawn, you want to yawn as well, right? Like when somebody yawns, it's almost like we have to fight. We feel tired and want to yawn as well. It's almost like a yawn can be contagious. One theory for why yawning is contagious is that early human beings, as hunter-gatherers, would go out on long hunts and communal hunts, but they didn't want to overexert themselves. So if one person was tired, if everyone else collectively realized they had used up their strength for the day, they would retire early. So those hunter-gatherer groups that had this kind of contagious yawn or were able to conserve their energy, they did better than other groups that overexerted themselves. Now, that's evolutionary psychology. Even Jerry Coyne, who is an atheist, who's a good researcher, because I mentioned he's an atheist not to say he's bad, but that some people use evolutionary psychology to try to say, to explain religion as just merely an evolutionary psychology story. But Jerry Coyne, who's an evolutionary biologist, he says that a lot of stories in evolutionary psychology are just that. They're stories, they're interesting accounts, but they don't prove what they're trying to explain. So that's just a possible thing there. So my point is that some human behavior, yawning seems to be contagious, laughter is contagious. I mean, it's kind of interesting when you listen to stand-up comedy, for example. When you listen to it by yourself, you'll probably laugh, but if you're sitting in an audience listening to a stand-up comedian and other people are laughing, you're more likely to laugh because they are laughing. So laughing is contagious, and that would explain the laughing epidemic and how it could spread among these young girls. And I would say that dancing is contagious. When one person starts dancing, it can loosen other people up, and then you got a dance party on your hands, people. Okay, our last two examples are probably the most modern examples of alleged mass hysteria. The first one, I think I've actually covered it on the podcast before, but it's worth bringing up again because I think it's just an absolutely fascinating case. And that is the case of the death of Gloria Ramirez. So it says here, Gloria Ramirez, she died on February 19th, 1994, was a woman from Riverside, California, who was dubbed the toxic lady or the toxic woman by the media when several hospital workers became ill after exposure to her body and blood. She had been admitted to the emergency department while suffering from late stage cervical cancer. So here's what happened. She went to the emergency department about 8:15 p.m. from heart palpitations. Tachycardia, you know, her heart is beating extremely fast, and the staff injected her with some medication to sedate her, and they then tried to, you know, she wasn't responding to the medication well, so they defibrillated her heart to try to get her heart beating at a normal rate. It says at that point, several people saw an oily sheen covering Ramirez's body, and some noticed a fruity garlic-like odor that they thought was coming from her mouth. A registered nurse named Susan Kane tried to draw blood from Ramirez's arm and noticed an ammonia-like smell coming from the tube. And actually, when they looked at her blood, they saw in it, it looked like these kind of gold flakes. But then what happened is the nurses passed the syringe to a medical resident named Julie Gorchinsky, who saw the gold particles in the blood. At that point, the other nurse, Kane, fainted and was removed. Susan Kane fainted and was removed from the room. Then Gorchinsky felt nauseated. She felt lightheaded. A respiratory therapist passed out. And then everybody, the staff and the patients, were evacuated into the parking lot. And it says 23 people became ill and 5 were hospitalized. And then a skeleton crew went back in to try to help Ramirez, who died after about 45 minutes of CPR and defibrillation. Her autopsy said she died from kidney failure related to her cancer. All right, so what happened? Was Gloria Ramirez this incredibly toxic woman that made everybody sick? That's one theory, and I am highly inclined to believe that that is the theory. Another common theory that the hospital maintains is that this is just a case of mass hysteria, that people saw strange things in Ramirez, like the oily secretion or the particles in her blood or the smells, and they thought it was odd. And when one person experienced a reaction to the strangeness of the situation, that reaction became contagious and affected other people. And then the nausea, the fainting spells, that this was just an example of mass hysteria, people copying that kind of behavior. And that's possible. It's certainly possible this is just mass hysteria. But I think when you read the details of the account and the strange physical elements related to Ramirez and how quickly this spread, even to people who had not witnessed the fainting or the nausea, but suddenly became overwhelmed. I think this is more likely, to me, a combination of drugs that were in her system, like her anti-cancer drugs that she was taking, mixed with the defibrillator or some kind of combination of chemicals and drugs created a unique reaction in Gloria's body to create some kind of a gas or a nauseating substance of some kind. So I think there's good evidence for that, but there also is evidence for it being mass hysteria because people have not been able to replicate what this substance exactly would have been under those circumstances. So maybe it was mass hysteria, maybe not. I'll link to the description of the case at trendhornpodcast.com if you would like to read more about it. And finally, the last one is the Pokemon hysteria. I'm not talking about the hysteria of people thinking that Pokemon are pocket monster little demons out to get you, but it was a hysteria related to epileptic seizures on the children's television show Pokemon. Gotta catch 'em all. Gotta catch 'em all. You better believe I watched Pokemon as a kid. You better believe that. I had the card games. I was playing with other people. I eventually got done with the Pokemon card game and moved on to Yu-Gi-Oh! Anybody know Yu-Gi-Oh! If you do, leave a comment at trendhornpodcast.com. But this is what happened. This was a case of mass hysteria in Japan. This is an article in the New York Post in 2001, reflecting on the incident that occurred on December 16th in 1997. It says, just 30 minutes after the show ended, 618 children. So this is an episode of the television show Pokemon, aired in Japan, December 16th, 1997. It says, after the show ended, 618 children were rushed to Japanese hospitals complaining of symptoms that suggested epileptic seizures. They included convulsions, lapses in awareness, nausea, headaches, and blurred visions. Doctors said the seizures were due to photosensitive epilepsy that resulted of a scene in the cartoon that included a series of strobe-like flashes. The event became international news. Within 2 days, some 13,000 children needed medical help for seizures. So you had 600 Japanese children are all at home watching Pokemon. And I've watched this scene online. There's the character Pikachu. He has this Thunderbolt attack. And he uses it to destroy these two missiles. I think they're called vaccine missiles. I have no idea what's going on in the plot. And this is straight up Japanese Pokemon. This is not the American version of it. So it gets weird. I don't even know. But I've watched the scene where the missiles explode and the entire screen flashes red and blue very, very quickly. The whole screen is just red and blue flashing over and over. And I could see that causing an epileptic fit because the cones in our eyes are, you know, focus in on colors like red and blue. And so if they're flashing back and forth like that, that could trigger an epileptic fit. I mean, there are theaters that had, what was it? Well, Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker, when it came out, which I still haven't seen, by the way, and I refuse to see it because it's terrible, but that's a show for another time. It came out with a warning saying that several sequences with imagery and sustained flashing lights may affect those who are susceptible to photosensitive epilepsy or other photosensitivity. So this is something that can happen to people. I would also put a warning on their warning. This may affect people who have epilepsy or who actually care about Star Wars and don't want the trilogy ruined because it wasn't thought out well because you gave episode 8 to Rian Johnson. Just leave it to JJ and let him do his own story. Oh, sorry. That's an episode for another. I'll do a Star Wars rant maybe in a few weeks here. We'll see if that can fit in. Well, my point is that I've seen this clip. I could see how it would cause a few hundred, you know, as you have millions of people watching the show, a few hundred get the epilepsy triggered. But upon hearing that people got epilepsy, over 10,000 Japanese children claim to have had epileptic fits after watching this when they actually didn't. The article goes on to say that experts say only a small fraction of the kids were actually diagnosed with photosensitive epilepsy. The answer is that this triggered a case of mass hysteria. What I found most interesting is the notion of how an idea can spread from person to person and be transformed into physical symptoms. So, hey, just remember the lesson of the day with mass hysteria is this. It's a good lesson in life in general. Our brains are programmed to follow the crowd. And sometimes the crowd gets things right, but sometimes they don't. So don't just follow the crowd. Follow the evidence. 1 Thessalonians 5:21 says, test everything, retain what is good. Don't retain what is merely hysterical, retain what is good. So I hope you enjoyed that. I'll leave links to what I talked about at trendhornpodcast.com. If you become a premium subscriber, you get access to those show notes. You can comment on the episode, message me, watch our catechism study series. And if you're a silver level subscriber or higher, you get a fancy mug. All kinds of great stuff. And you can submit questions for our future episodes. But hope you enjoyed that. And I hope you enjoy your weekend. God bless everyone.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.